Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today, I'm blasted to have Mads Torgersen. He is the program manager at Microsoft, who is responsible for the development of C#, and here to talk about C# 7. Mads, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am great and very excited to have you here both as yourself, but frankly also to talk about C# 7 because there's some very exciting things going on there.
Yeah, I hope so. Happy to be here too.
So give me a high-level, 20,000-foot overview of C# 7, and then we can dive a little bit deeper.
So C# 7 is a release with, I guess, no particular singular theme to it. It's to some degree a grab bag of new features, all aimed at general productivity improvements. If you squint, though, you can see some there's some themes running through there in terms of working better with data. And so our top two features probably are tuples, which let you work better with groups of values, like multiple returns, for instance, and pattern matching, which is an improvement to how you decide what to do based on the shape of data.
Okay, tuples and pattern matching. And what are some of the other features that we're looking at?
Well, there's a bunch of what you might call slightly smaller features. There is the ability to write methods inside of other methods. We call that local functions. So if you have little helper methods that aren't really important to any other method or property body or whatever than the one you're in, you can put them locally and then they can see whatever parameters and locals are in scope. I guess if you want to take that to the extreme, you could also do the more nested functions style of programming that you see, for instance, in many JavaScript programs.
Yes, these internal methods have access to the variables of the outer method?
They do, yes.
And what about the other way? Does the parent method have access into the inner method?
No, it only has access to the method itself, being able to call it.
Right, okay. For a minute there, that sounded bizarre, but I could see how useful that could be.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, it's something that's been around in programming languages for probably half a century. We just never had that that ability to nest in C#, and actually many modern programming languages don't. But if you look at the functional family of languages, it's very common, and even Pascal has this. So this is sort of just us catching up. In a way, we've had it for a long time in a convoluted way through the ability to write lambdas, which are also functions that are inside other functions and can access the enclosing state. But lambdas they're great if you actually want to have a delegate and pass them to something else, like you do with link or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they're too much bother if you're really just looking to have a local function. Like you have to, and they're also less efficient. You have to assign them to a delegate typed variable, and so you have to create a delegate that allocates, and you have to. There are all these things that you have to do. Also, they can't be recursive without special tricks and so on. So it's just a much more natural little, really sort of half of the underlying feature of lambdas, if you will, that we've exposed. Just the ability to declare a named function.
We're going to come back to the big two. You say tuples or tuples?
So I say tuples, but I realize that both the pronunciations are out there, and I'm not a native English speaker, so I just picked it up from whatever people said in my particular environment. I fully respect and endorse both pronunciations.
Is your original language Norwegian?
Danish. So very
Danish. Sorry.
You may be confused by the last name, which derives from Norway.
Got it. Well, your English is a heck of a lot better than my Danish.
Oh, thank you. So, I guess
I can say that. So we'll continue in English. Tell me about some of the other small features that are in there, and let's start with out variables. What are they, and why do I want them?
So they are sort of a bit related, if you will, to pattern matching. So they're actually probably a good stepping stone to talking about pattern matching a little later. Okay. So for better or worse, you could say the C# language has out and ref parameters. And out parameters in particular are a way, they're sort of the old-fashioned way of getting multiple results.
Yes.
And even as we are making that scenario easier with tuples now, so you don't have to use out parameters as often anymore, there are still certain situations. First of all, there's a lot of code out there that has out parameters already, and you want to work well with that. But there are also certain patterns where out parameters are really the right thing to do. For instance, if you think about try parse or try get methods, so this try pattern, mm-hmm. where the method itself returns a bool saying whether you were successful when you tried. And then there's some data that you also want to transport back to the caller in the event of success. and you pass that back through an out parameter. And that's actually better than returning, say, a tuple of Boolean and some data, because you want to be able to do these try calls directly inside of, say, an if condition, wherever you want a condition. And so it's important that it only returns a bool. And then it's nicer to get the results out through the out parameter. But then using an out parameter in itself in C# today is cumbersome, because you have to first, on a separate line before all this, you have to declare a variable and then pass that in. And you can't use var because where you declare the variable, you're not initializing it with anything. And so what we did was to make it so that you can declare that variable directly inside of the method call itself, right where you're passing the out argument. You can just say out int x, for instance, and that creates an int x variable on the spot and passes that as the out parameter, or to the out parameter.
I like that. It's similar to the ability in TypeScript to declare constructor parameters that then become fields of the class.
It probably is. Yeah. And the additional thing here is that because we're creating it, you're declaring it right where you're using it, we can actually see from the method signature what the type should be. And so you can use var instead of, out a list of dictionary of int and string. You can just say var.
Right. Out var. Always preferable. Great. Other smaller features, and then we'll come back to the big ones?
Yeah, a few other ones, I guess. Now we are on the sort of out and ref general area. We enable ref in a few more places in the language. People are familiar with ref parameters. They're not used very much in most kinds of code, but one of the things that ref parameters are really good for is passing structs in a cheaper way, because you pass a reference to the struct instead of copying the struct value itself. And of course, it's particularly useful if you want the receiver of it to mutate it. You're passing a ref to the original struct, so they're not mutating a copy, and you never see the result. So that's all nice and good. And for certain types of programming, such as game programming in Unity, for instance, you really depend on structs a lot, an arrays of structs, in order to represent your game state without having to allocate objects all the time. So ref style programming is very prevalent in that type of scenario. But it kind of gets limiting that the only thing you can do with refs is pass them. And so what we've enabled is you can also return by ref. A method can say go and look up a big struct in a big array and return a ref to that particular struct to the caller, and they can then access it directly through the ref. And in order to be able to do something useful with a returned ref, we also have ref locals, so you can have a local variable that holds on to a ref to a storage location somewhere that, for instance, was returned to you.
Okay, but for Joe Programmer, is the advantage of doing that that there's going to be a performance benefit, or why would I want to do it that way rather than just passing the object?
There can be both functional and performance reasons. It's let's just use the game example. I have a game loop, and I have a big array of game state. I probably have people who want to look for that asteroid, find that in that big game state array, and modify it as part of the game loop. The ability to, so it's not just avoiding the copying, it's actually important that you get a reference to the original, because that's the one you want to modify. And in that case, that gets kind of gnarly to program without refs. You have to maybe use indices and into the array, but then you need the caller to know about the array. And maybe it's not a flat array. Maybe you have nested structs or whatever. And how do you communicate back where something is if you can't send them a safe pointer, if you will?
Yeah.
So it is really a matter of improved functionality there. Admittedly, for a special scenario, it just seemed like it was sort of one of the top asks from the game community in order to make C# a little little slicker for the type of programming where you want to avoid allocations and therefore use structs a lot.
You have a lot of communities that you have to serve at the same time.
Yeah, general purpose programming language, right?
Yes, and one that's fairly mature. So adding on must be an interesting task to not break or regress with anything else.
That's certainly a big aspect of language design. People sometimes think that language design is very glamorous. We sit around and have ideas all day. Oh, that must be awesome. But really, most of our work these days, working on top of this 15-year-old language, is to, once we've had the idea, is to then try 20 or 200 different ways of realizing the idea that don't break with the existing language and that are efficient and that we can compile. And, you know, it's much more the, fitting into the many creative constraints that we have from being a mature language.
And just tangentially, ASP.NET, the decision was to tear it down and build it right back up, and it was sufficiently different that they renamed it to ASP.NET Core. Anything on the horizon that says C# is hitting a maturity level and it's time to build D?
Well, I think so ASP.NET, what you'll find is that ASP.NET Core isn't all that different from ASP.NET. And in particular, the underlying .NET Core is very, we're heading towards very strong compatibility with other .NETs, if you will, and kind of focusing on making it one platform. But that's an aside. That was more an analogy for you. On C# itself, you got to ask the question, when are you too hemmed in by creative constraints, or alternatively, the language is too big for its own good and for the good of its users, and it's better to start over? That's certainly a question we have to ask ourselves once in a while. What we've found, and I think we're surprised by this finding, is that it survives remarkably well. So I remember Anders saying in an interview maybe 7 or 8 years ago that C# had one or two more good versions in it. And we were sort of thinking, wow, okay, we can't do this for long. But somehow we seem to have kept the ability to evolve the language in a way that still, where it still is a language that people like and that sort of retains its coherence and unity, if you will.
Yes. Well, I could go on and on about why I'm totally devoted to C#. I was a C++ programmer. I saw some of the early bits of C# and never went back. And it is, in my opinion, it is an extraordinarily useful all-purpose language that is not terribly hard to get your head around, which keeps it to be very, very valuable, I think.
Well, now I'm glad it's a podcast, because now I'm blushing, actually. Thanks. Yeah, you've been in C# longer than I have. So it's been interesting. Well, I've witnessed most of that progression, and it's interesting how I think it's held up a lot better than any of us expected. And I think we do put very much of an emphasis on, even as we borrow vigorously and boldly from traditions such as functional programming, we have tried to sort of maintain a core spirit of the language through all these additions and extensions of the language over time. And I hope that shows, because once you start having multiple sub-languages, if you will, then it gets hard to be one language anymore. It has to be so that people can read each other's source code, and there's sort of a bit of a unifying principle still in the language.
Yes, and I think it is, to your question, I think it is still very coherent. And C# programmers are C# programmers, although game programmers with C# are, cousins. they've got a different world.
There's definitely a little bit of that, right? But hopefully that's more a question of selectively avoiding a few features of the language, but you're still essentially programming in C#. That's what
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So let me bring you to the two big additions to the language, and then if any other additions make sense to talk about at the same time, that would be great. And why don't we start with tuples and what they are and what they're for and how they're going to make my life easier.
Right. So, There's a number of places in programming where you have some known set of typed values that you just want to shunt around, and they're sort of temporarily traveling together, if you will. I think there's one place where the language already supports that well, which is in parameter lists. So you say, I need one of these and one of these and one of these, and people pass those in, and they travel together just in that method call, but they don't really have much to do with each other. But there are other situations, and of course the directly sort of symmetric situation to parameters is results. Right? I want to produce a number of results, and that number is not always one.
Yes.
So everybody can probably relate to the dilemma of, oh, I want to actually return these two things from this method. What do I do now? Should I? And I have a bunch of bad options here. I can use out parameters, and then I'm encumbering the consumer of this method with having to conjure up variables and pass them in. I can build my own transport type, and then I'm complicating my interface and giving myself extra work, and I'm leaving the user also with this weird type that they have to interact with, even though it has no sort of business level meaning. It's just a suitcase of values.
We've all written classes that their only purpose is to be able to return multiple values.
Yes, foo result.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you can use a system.tuple and you can instantiate that yourself. But then you have a bunch of complexity around that as well. And when you consume it, your only option is to access the individual members with item one, item two, and so on. So all business level meaning is gone. So, and there are also uses of dynamic and all that kind of stuff. There are all these things that people do to try to make it tolerable. So we've said, okay, time for us to just address this head on and have a way to temporarily group a bunch of values together in a strongly typed way. And that's where tuples come in. So a tuple is a type. There's a tuple type now in C#, I think is the way to say it, which you can express with syntax. You know, it's open paren and then, type with commas in between. And then you can actually have optional names on those individual parts. So it looks very much like a parameter list. That's a tuple type, and you can put that as the return type. And then your method starts looking more symmetric, right? Then it has some things coming in and some things coming out. And those things can have names. To accompany the tuple types, there's a notion of tuple literals tuple expressions where you create a new tuple from constituent values. And then that can be assigned to that tuple type. And that's really all there is to it.
Let me back you up. Mm-hmm. In one case, if I understand you, I've got a method foo and it takes a string and a bool.
Yeah.
And it returns two ints and a string. So I put a parenthesis and I say int value one comma, int value two comma string, name, close parenthesis.
Yes.
And those three values then become visible to the calling function.
Yeah. So the way it works when you call it is that, you get one thing back. You get a tuple back.
Mm-hmm.
And you can choose to treat it as a thing. So that's where it's a little different from a parameter list. There is actually a thing that is a tuple. And I won't say an object at runtime because it's actually a struct. But there's a thing, a value that contains the other values, if you will. And you can choose to take that and assign it into a variable. You can say var t equals and then call foo and you get that tuple. And if you want to, it actually lets you access the variable or the values inside using generic names like item one, item two, and so on. But the names, if you chose to give it names in the method signature, you can also use those nice names, if you will. So in your example, you said value one. Well, that would be it could also be first, last, or whatever, descriptive mm-hmm. names. You can use those and you can dot into the tuple and use those names.
All right, that was my question. So if I say var t equal function one and it returns a tuple, I can then say t dot first name, t dot last name.
Yes.
But the tuple itself is only the only, try that again in English. The extent to which it has a name is because I said var t. It doesn't exist as something that has its own intrinsic name that somehow passed around.
Yeah, it's just an ordinary, think of it as an ordinary struct, really.
Okay.
You just get that back. And when you say var t, that struct is assigned into t.
Okay. And then you seemed, if I remember, you seemed to talk about a different way of dealing with it where it's more of a type. And can you help me understand the difference?
So the consumption pattern I just explained is sort of, that is where you treat the tuple as a value. But if you actually want to think of it more as, I just think of it as several values coming back to me from the call. What you can choose to do is you can deconstruct that value when it comes back. So that's another new concept in C#, deconstruction. So instead of saying var t and getting the tuple, I can say open paren, var value one, var first name, comma, var last name, close paren, equals. So I'm declaring multiple variables in parens, and then each of those variables gets one of the values from the tuple, if you will. And so we split the tuple right back up into several variables directly at the call site. And no one ever sees the tuple itself. It just gets immediately deconstructed into its parts.
And can those parts have different names, assuming they have the same type?
Yeah. I mean, you decide the names of your variables, and they don't have to match up with the names that you put in the tuple type. They are just variable names of your choosing. If you want to abbreviate or use different names or whatever, that's totally up to you. And in that case, when you deconstruct, the names in the tuple type itself, the return type of the method, they don't really have a function, semantically speaking, at that point, right? Because you just deconstruct them based on their position. You know, there's three of them, coming from the method, and you declare three variables in parens, and they sort of just get assigned based on where they are, which number of those three they are, right? But the names are still useful in terms of documentation of what it is you get back. And so when you hover over the method call, in Visual Studio, for instance, it'll tell you, well, you know, it's the first name and the last name, not the other way around.
Yes. So what are the use cases for dotting into a tuple declared with var t versus what you've just described?
I think it's a matter of style, really. I think sometimes you call a tuple returning method and you're really only interested in one of them, one of the results in the tuple, and then you'll just do the method call and you'll say dot and get that thing out. Sometimes you're interested in passing the tuple itself along to something else, maybe, or storing it somewhere. So it's really it's mostly a matter of style, though. You can achieve the same scenarios with both. It just sometimes one feels more natural than the other.
Okay. In a parameter list, there is a way you can designate that there's going to be an unknown number of parameters that you then treat as an array. Is there anything like that with tuples?
That's interesting to consider, but well, we haven't so far.
Okay.
I mean, you could certainly have the last element of the tuple be an array. Mm-hmm. But there's not a way to params it so that you are, you know, the equivalent would be something like allowing tuple literals of arbitrary length to then be assigned to a tuple type with params and the last one. I guess we could speculate about such a feature. I don't know if it's all that useful.
Well, when you implement it, I'm hoping you will name it Liberty Tuples.
Ah, yeah. Well, now you're talking. Well, how about we see, once people start using tuples, whether, there's an actual need for this. Sometimes we just don't have the imagination, to really understand what there's a need for. And we need to see people clamoring for it. Like, here is a program where I could really use this. And if we see enough of those, we're like, well, okay, maybe we should add it. And we could always do that in the next version of C#. Because there's always the next version of C#.
That's right. That's right. And I think people really appreciate how much the creation of additional features is responsive to the community requests or demands or whining, whatever it is we're doing with it.
Right. I mean, that is one of our absolutely top sources of input, right? It's what people, whenever people claim, you know, complain that something is too cumbersome, that's when we really listen. We get a lot of feature proposals that are just proposals. Wouldn't it be neat if I could do this and this? And we can intellectually appreciate that, wow, yes, that would be neat. But unless it's coupled with this would make this or that style of programming or this particular scenario much easier for me, then it doesn't really have much weight, right? Because it's just sort of for the fun of it.
Yes.
And so, so really at the core is what can make people's actual code, you know, easier to write, easier to read, easier to maintain. What can kind of take you to the next level of productivity and clarity of your code? That's the kind of thing that we are looking for. And one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, we're a mainstream programming language in the sense that, we have to be approachable. And so there are certainly things that we could, sometimes we can see, well, this kind of feature would be cool, but it's way beyond sort of the range of experience of most developers today. And so there's always this balancing act between sometimes you want to mainstream something, as mainstream as a verb, right? You can do that in English.
Yes.
And we do that sometimes where we say, okay, mainstream languages up until now have not had this feature, whereas it's prevalent in, say, you know, functional languages or something. And we take it upon ourselves to do the work to mainstream it, to fit it in. And sometimes ideas are too far away from that. And sometimes other languages mainstream things and we realize, maybe we should have thought of that, but we can always steal it. And so, what I'm trying to say is a set of features that are sort of, acceptable to put into a mainstream programming language, that boundary moves all the time. And That's part of the reason why a language like C# evolves. It's not just that we think of new things. It's that the world around us evolves. There are both new scenarios to address new problems that people have because of those new scenarios. And there are also other languages that are also moving the state of the art forward. And a good language designer has to be willing to steal liberally from those other languages. We do that.
Fair enough. We have not talked about pattern matching.
Right.
Of all the things that is new in C# 7, it seems like that might be the hardest to get your head around.
Yeah, there's something about the term pattern matching that has some people react a little like they do to the term monads.
Exactly.
My eyes are already glazing over. I can't hear what you're saying anymore. So let's try to demystify it a little bit. Let's take a simple example, right? You're looking at, you get some input and it's an animal, but you don't know if it's a tiger or a snake or whatever. And so you're going to have different code depending on what it is. So you have this sort of shape dependent programming, right? Sometimes in classic object oriented programming, the way you're shape dependent is you foresee this need when you first declare the types and you put a virtual method in the base class and implement that in everything that, that derives from it, right? So, but you can't always foresee that need. You are not always the person who wants the shape dependent functionality, or it's not always the same person who writes the class hierarchy or defines the types or whatever, right? In reality, nowadays, the data shapes are much more centralized phenomenon. They're the data that go on the wire, and the functionality that depends on the shapes is more local, maybe depends on the scenario you're solving in your particular app or part of the backend or whatever. And so then there's a need to separate the defining of the shapes or the types and the writing of code that depends on what shape you're looking at. That was sort of a big backstory there, if you will. But so how do you do that in C# today? Well, it's kind of gnarly. I walk up to this thing. I have to test what its type is. I'm essentially asking, are you a snake? And so you do that with an is expression, mm-hmm. with snake. And once you know that, oh, it's snake, well, then you immediately have to do something more, because even though you now know it's a snake, the compiler has already forgotten it. And when you start using O as a snake, it says, well, O is an O, not a snake. And so you have to cast it as well. And in its simplest form, the kind of pattern matching that we're adding to C# today is really just a solution to that problem. And the very simplest expression of that is, instead of saying O is snake, you can say O is snake S. And so it tests whether O is a snake and returns true, just like before, if it is. But if it is, then additionally, it assigns the snake into this variable S. And
so how help me with, how is that different from S equals O as snake?
It's different in that the things are combined together. If you do what you describe, then you still have a test to do after.
Right, for null.
So there's a test, and regardless of how you turn your code today, you have to do a test at some point, and you have to do a cast or an as at some point. And those are separate, and you can't avoid doing both. Here, they're sort of built together into one feature, if you will. So the you get this variable S that has a snake in it if the is expression was true. And then the compiler knows this. So if you're in the then branch of an if statement that had that is expression as its condition, then it knows that there's a snake in the S, that it's that S is assigned.
Yes.
And this plays well with sort of the definite assignment analysis of the compiler. And so it knows there's a snake in there, and it lets you use that. Whereas if you're in the else branch, it knows that you were false and S is not necessarily a sign, and it won't let you actually even dot into it or whatever. So it protects you from a null value or something that might be in there.
How does that work and play with switch statements?
So this works also with switch statements. Switch statements traditionally in C# are sort of almost our most old-fashioned feature, if you will. It goes all the way back to how switches have always been in C, and you can only switch on constants, or you can only switch on expressions of simple primitive types, and then all your cases have to be constant. So we really took and gave switch statements an overhaul, where you can now switch on anything, and your case clauses can be, you know, again, case snake S. So I switch on the animal, and I have a case that says snake S. And that means that inside of that, under that case label, S is assigned with a snake. And you can start going to town on that one. So, and additionally, actually, in switch statements, we also added the ability to put a, an additional condition on the case. So you can say, you know, case snake S where, oh, sorry, when S dot length is greater than 6 feet or whatever, you know, I'll only deal with the long snakes here. So you can put extra conditions, just Boolean expressions, in there, and the case will only trigger if that Boolean condition is also met in addition to the pattern.
And that could clean up a lot of code.
Yeah. So now, if you're trying to, if you're going through the zoo and trying to, do things that depend on what kind of animal you're looking at, you just use the switch statement for that. And that really, that's sort of really the core of it. I think so. This is kind of simple pattern matching. It's probably the most useful sort of pattern you can think of, but where the snake S is really the pattern, the combination of test that it's a snake and assign it into as a variable if it is. But in the future of the language, like in subsequent versions, I think we can think of more fancy patterns too. We'll have to kind of evaluate as we go which patterns are useful and intuitive enough that we want them in.